Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in tonight to Freedom Fighters for America Radio. We have with us Mr. Rodney Stitch, former FAA flight investigator. Welcome to the show, Mr. Stitch.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. Can you please give me a little bit more of your background? I know there's a heck of a lot more there than I just announced.
Well, okay, I started out as a Navy patrol plane commander in World War II. Then I was an international airline pilot for many years, and part of that time was flying in the Middle East. Matter of fact, I was in Iran the morning of the revolution in 1953 when the CIA subverted the government. And then after I left airline flying eventually, and I became a FAA airline safety inspector, investigator. And in that position, in those days, we were having a major airline disaster about every few months. And that went on for about 15 years. But we had so many of them. About a year after I went with the FAA, they came to me and asked me to take on an assignment to correct the conditions that at that time were responsible for the worst series of airline disasters in the nation's history. Well, that started me off in learning about what went on in government. And from that point on, I mean, I found a lot of corruption. People might find that hard to believe that in an industry where corruption has such catastrophic consequences that it could exist. Well, it exists there just like in any other government agency. Now, today we don't have as many crashes as we had in those days, but that was the improvement came about from other conditions. The same basic conditions still exist, and this is why you had the hijackings of four airliners on 9/11. But and at any rate, after discovering all of the corruption that was going on there, and of course with that comes the cover-ups. And cover-ups are endemic in the United States. And so I did a number of things trying to get the information out. I filed federal lawsuits in the federal courts trying to report the corruption that I discovered. And, of course, there I just ran into another block. And so I decided, well, I will go directly to the public by publishing books and appearing as guests on radio and television shows. And I started that in 1978. I've been on over 3,000 radio and TV shows since that time. But one of the things that it did for me was other government agents started coming to me, and former drug smugglers, former mafia guys. So over the last 20 years or so, they've all been feeding me information on corruption that they discovered in government. So with this information, then I started writing other books. But one of my latest books has to do with probably the greatest scandal of modern times that has caused the granddaddy of catastrophic consequences. Now, my information is all, it's factual and documented. I don't go into any conspiracy theories. And I have a lot of credibility. So right now, the latest book is the Crimes of the FBI, DOJ, Mafia, and Al-Qaeda. And all three of those, well, all are combined in what I call what has resulted in what I call the granddaddy of conspiracies and granddaddy of catastrophic consequences.
Mm-hmm. And what is the granddaddy?
Well, the granddaddy of
9/11
scandals Well, it's hard to give the full story in a quick sound bite, but I go into the corruption that I first discovered, that's in the FAA. Then I go into the corruption that I discovered in the FBI and the Department of Justice offices. And then after that, there's the cover-ups by members of Congress. And that I've documented that for the last 40 years. As a matter of fact, on my website, Defrauding America, many of the letters appear that I sent to members of Congress reporting different areas of corruption that I and my my group of my coalition of other insiders have discovered.
Is that you, sir, or is that this? Hold on. Okay. Still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. How many of the insiders in our government that you've contacted, how many are still in our government today? Are there quite a few?
Well, most of them are former government agents, because while when they're still in there, like, let's see, let me just give a few quick examples. We had Ocho Pinti, who was the head of a drug interagency drug task force in the New York City area. We had an FBI agent who worked under an FBI supervisor in New York City. This is a fellow, a former highly decorated Vietnam pilot. He worked under the Lindley DeVicio, and DeVicio, as you probably have already reported, was involved in serial murders with a key mafia guy by the name of Gregory Scarpa Sr. Mm-hmm. And now with Ocho Pinti, he was exposing the drug trafficking in the New York, New Jersey area that was funding, among other people, the Al-Qaeda cell in Jersey City. So anyhow, the Justice Department charged him with criminal violations of civil rights of some of the drug smugglers. And what he allegedly did, he did not obtain verbal authority to investigate the bodegas where a lot of the drug trafficking was going on. Another one of my sources was a fellow with U.S. Customs along the California-Mexican border who was complaining about the drug shipments coming through from Mexico that his superiors were blocking from being investigated. Then I have a long list of others on my website. Were former government agents. But my sources go back way, way back. These are people that were involved in October Surprise, people that were involved in the drug smuggling during the Reagan-Bush administration and the Iran-Contra affair. And a couple of my sources were involved in this Operation Tailwind. That's where the U.S. was hunting down military personnel that had defected. That's the type of stuff. And then also some of them were, some of the CIA assets were, had covert CIA companies that dealt in savings and loan frauds, financial frauds, drug smuggling, things like that. Now, most of the public is either illiterate about these things or they can't believe that they exist. And thanks to the public's naivety, we've had, for instance, there was such a breakdown in virtually every government entity that was responsible for preventing like 9/11, there was that corruption still exists. The same culture of corruption that made possible the housing and financial scandals, they're still with us. So the public's naivety makes these things possible, and of course these are still existing. So what I do is I try to write books, let the public know what by being indifferent on these matters, how they're paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go into one of these instances where you've spoken to people inside our government or inside these agencies, the CIA or whatever government agency we're talking about, local PDs or whatever. Now, they've given you an instance of corruption. They've given you a specific instance of corruption where they have discovered where there was drug dealing going on between organized crime being condoned or allowed by bribery through some enforcement officials. And then, of course, you file this information or complaint with the federal government.
Yes,
and
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Can you give us a specific instance where was it the CIA involved? Was it the local enforcement network? On our past show, we've spoken about Lindley Del Vecchio and that whole thing where there was 8 mob murders and all of that. But what instance, where let's say a guy like Del Vecchio was part of this drug dealing team and was working not only with a mob, but was working, like as a double agent, so to speak. He would take care of people that the mob wanted him to whack out or to get information on. And, do you understand where I'm coming from here? Here's a guy put into place, but he's working both sides of the fence. He's working as an agent, but yet he's also working with a mob.
No, let me, let's see, there's so many examples I can give you, but let me stick to what you've just mentioned. I first started finding out about the Vecchio from about 15 years ago. This mm-hmm. I learned this from this FBI agent who worked under the Vecchio. And you'll have to excuse my pronunciation of the name. That may not be quite correct. But at any rate, what he did, now, he's a highly decorated Vietnam pilot. He had many decorations, lieutenant colonel. He's working as an FBI agent in the New York City office. Mm-hmm. And he's discovering and trying to report, for instance, there was a CIA opera, a covert CIA operation in the New York City area that was funding and arming Iraq during the 1980s. This is during the Reagan-Bush administration. So he's trying to report this, and his boss is telling him, knock it off. Then he's discovering, different mob activities, and the Vecchio keeps telling him, look, terminate that process. So what he did then, Richard Tossett was the name of the FBI agent, he wrote a letter to members of Congress. And if he had told me before he did that, I would have told him that's a total waste of time. And all they're going to do is they turn the letter over to the Department of Justice guys that were covering up for all this. So the first thing they did to him, they charged, to get him immediately out of the office, they charged him with misusing a government-issued credit card. 4 years earlier, he had put $8 worth of gas in his car while he's on a government surveillance using his private car. But that got him out of the office. And then what they managed to do, and this I noticed is not too hard to do, the state prosecutors then charged him with improper conduct with some teenagers. So anyhow, he was sentenced to, he's in Dannemora, New York now. I think it was a 50-year prison sentence he got for allegedly having sexual conduct with those teenagers. But then some years later, I started, and this is in 2002, Gregory Scarpa Jr. contacted me. So he started giving me all of the information about how his father was involved in serial murders with DiVicio. So now, about the same time when he's telling me this, the House Judiciary Committee was conducting hearings on murders perpetrated by FBI agents in the Boston office with organized crime figures. So I contacted every member of the House Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. I think there was about 24 of them, notifying them that I had two witnesses, and that would be, of course, my former FBI agent and a mafia guy. And I offered to provide them the information about murders that were occurring in the New York City office. Well, would you believe it? Not a single one of them responded, even though I identified myself as a former government agent. And you can't have any better witnesses than this, than an FBI agent and the son of a major mafia figure.
You're talking about Gregory Scarpa Jr., right?
Yeah, so anyhow, this is in 2002. Then, of course, as you know, 4 years later, the Brooklyn district attorney, I guess he was forced to file murder charges because of the media publicity that was developing. And so murder charges were filed against the DiVicio. And then all of a sudden, and totally contrary to prosecutor conduct, well, first the first witness was the mistress or the common law wife of Gregory Scarpa Sr. And she provided very reliable, very specific information about the murders. Well, without going into too many details.
What type of information did she provide? What was she saying? What was she claiming?
She had information about being present when DiVicio and Gregory Scarpa Sr. were talking about people that had to be bumped off because Scarpa was being given the information of government informants.
Mm-hmm.
So government informants go to the FBI to give information. So now the FBI or DiVicio then tells Scarpa, hey, you got to get rid of this person.
Right.
So there was at least four murders in which an FBI supervisor was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, what then happened, there was one reporter that had been giving information about, I think it was about 10, some years earlier, by Mary was the first name of the common law wife of Gregory Scarpa Sr. And apparently for a possible book deal, she withheld some information that was being given to the reporters. Well, she had another reason to withhold information because she didn't feel like she wanted to get murdered by the FBI supervisor. So anyhow, now she's testifying on oath. So she's giving the full story. So the reporter comes forward and say, hey, this is the same line she gave us earlier. So all of a sudden, as if on command, the district attorney then dismisses and the charges. Well, now the district attorney still had Gregory Scarpa Jr. that they knew all of the information that Scarpa Jr. would be able to provide. Mm-hmm. So they refused to allow Scarpa to appear. So I feel that there was pressure put on the Brooklyn DA by the Department of Justice guys. Well, now, in my latest book, I have two letters. One letter was from the district attorney. I forget who the letter was addressed to, but the letter highly praised Gregory Scarpa Jr. for the credibility of the testimony that he would provide. Now, that letter, incidentally, was written by the same office, district attorney's office, that had dismissed the charges. So why that letter was written, I can't comprehend that. Mm-hmm. And then there was another thing now. Now, the judge that dismissed the charges against the FBI supervisor threatened the common law wife with perjury. So they didn't even let her testify to address the conflict in the testimony. But anyhow, it was turned over to a special prosecutor who was a retired judge. Well, I got a copy recently of the report by that judge, and the judge highly praised the common law wife with about her testimony, felt and stated it was very accurate, and there were some serious problems here that should be investigated, but that were outside of his authorization.
Okay, so let me ask you something here. So, in other words, she was going to be charged with perjury. There was a special investigator, a retired judge, who came in and investigated that testimony, which they claimed was perjury, and found that to be accurate information, and she did not perjure herself. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. And that report is in my latest book, which is the one, Crimes of the FBI, DOJ, Mafia, and Al-Qaeda. And so I have excerpts of the report, and it's quite a long report. I don't remember how many pages, but it was at least a dozen pages.
Right. Let's go back 1 second to Richard Taus. Now, Richard Taus lived in Suffolk County, New York. Okay, he worked in the New York field office. He was accused for using government funds when he put $4 of gasoline in his own personal automobile while he was on surveillance or while he was working at that specific moment of time.
Yes, 4 years. He had to go back quite a ways.
Now he had to fight. Now he was fighting that charge, obviously. So they came up with another charge and said that he was having inappropriate activity with minors. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so now he's in Dannemora prison for 50 years on trumped-up charges. And I have heard in the past, you know, we do speak to some mutual people. I don't know if you speak to many of them anymore. But what they were telling me at one particular point in time, there was some kind of action to try to get Richard Taus out of jail. Was there anything ever incorporated in doing that?
Well, now, Richard Taus had put a petition in to Governor Patterson about 6 months ago for clemency. I'm glad you brought that up, because here's another angle to this. On the basis of Taus's petition, what I did, I wrote a certified letter to Governor Patterson, and I notified him, first of all, of the people I had that was providing me information about the murders performed by the FBI supervisor and how that played a role in going after Taus. Mm-hmm. And now he didn't even respond to that. So I sent another letter to New York Inspector General, I believe it was. And I also told them, I said, look, you've got a phony dropping of murder charges by one of your state prosecutors here, Somebody's getting away with serial murders, and I gave them the information that indicates that. And I also told them about, of course, the letters I had received that was praising Gregory Scarpa Jr. And also the report by the special investigator. So I should have had some type of response. Everybody is covering up. But this is something I've noticed over many, many years. If the scandal is real big, I mean real serious, everybody covers up. And just like with members of Congress, you know, the letters I send are very factual. They're not vague on some vague complaint. They're describing specific criminal acts. And the only time I ever got responses were while I was still in the FAA and reporting the corruption that I had discovered. I would get letters back whereby the recipients admitted the gravity of what I was saying, but then they said it's not in their area of responsibilities. Well, of course, tell that to the people jumping out of the World Trade Center, because they would not be in that position if it wasn't for the corruption that I brought to members of Congress' attention years earlier.
Right. Now, you had brought the fact that we're not secure, and that you listed many different ways in order to made suggestions in securing them. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So they didn't follow through with that, and the hijackings took place. And they wouldn't have taken place if they had followed your suggestions in how to secure specific areas.
But let me do that right. A little more thoroughly now.
Okay, please.
Now, a year before, well, first of all, my first letters, my first federal actions were filed in the late 1970s, and they were filed on the two particular federal statutes. The main one was the Federal Crime Reporting Statute. That's Title 18, USC Section 4. And that says that anyone who knows of a federal crime must report it to a federal judge or the federal officer. Well, since all the other federal officers were covering up, I felt, okay, I'll make a record. I'll report it to a federal judge in writing. Now, I filed a lawsuit on it. Now, under law, the federal judge must receive that information as part of his administrative duties, not judicial duties. What he does with it after that, then that's out of my hands.
Right.
But when I filed the first one, well, first of all, the judges, and I filed them in San Francisco. The first two or three that I filed, the judges admitted, yes, Mr. Stitch, these are serious charges, but it's up to Congress to investigate. And I'm telling him, look, I'm not asking you to investigate because, first of all, Congress is covering up, but I'm reporting it to you as I'm required to do. Well, every time I filed the actions in the beginning, the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney filed motions blocking me from reporting these things and requesting that they be dismissed. Well, then I would file appeal, and then I'd file written briefs, and also I'm there making oral arguments. And again, they admitted the seriousness of it. And then I went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court justices knew about the criminal activities and also the obstruction of justice by the federal judges over whom they had supervisory responsibility. Well, over a period of years, as I'm discovering other areas of corruption, CIA drug trafficking or October Surprise, I'm filing other actions, and they keep blocking me. So I made one last attempt before 9/11. And I filed a federal action in the federal courts in Reno, Nevada, and I named as defendants in there, and I identified the corruption, first of all, in the FAA. Now, the FAA has the primary responsibility for preventing any type of aviation disaster, and that's including hijackings. And I also reported the corruption of the FBI DOJ. And, of course, it was the FBI DOJ that had advanced information on the planned terrorist attacks that Gregory Scarpa Jr. was obtaining directly from Ramzi Youssef, who was the main bomb-making agent for al-Qaeda. And for 9 months, Scarpa is providing information to the FBI agents, and the FBI agents recognize the seriousness of it, because, first of all, I give Scarpa a camera to take pictures of all the notes that were being passed between Ramzi Youssef and one of his other al-Qaeda operatives there while they were in prison in New York and at the Metropolitan Correctional Center. And also, the FBI was so confident of the value of this information, they set up a fictitious mafia company in New York City. And Gregory Scarpa then told Youssef, now look, you make a local call to this mafia outfit and that they would forward the calls to his al-Qaeda operative. So calls were being made for quite a period of time to al-Qaeda operatives in the New York, New Jersey area, and also to the Middle East. So all of this, I mean, everybody was convinced of the value of this testimony. But what happened then, the reason the information wasn't passed along to other government departments that could have prevented, taken actions to prevent the terrorist acts, this information wasn't passed to them because the Department of Justice high-level personnel were planning to discredit Scarpa, because Scarpa was going to be testifying about the murders, the serial murders that his father and DiVicchio were doing. So since they were planning to discredit him, they couldn't now use his information and pass it along to other government officers. So as a result of that, there were about 3,500 people that were killed, a minor item. That, of course, includes 9/11, and that, of course, led to the invasion of two countries. And when that will end, who knows? So this is a major scandal, and there's never been, and it's the granddaddy of scandals and the granddaddy of catastrophic consequences. So you can see why nobody will touch it.
Well, there's a lot of corruption there, and there's a lot of players involved in this game, obviously.
Let me add one other thing here.
Sure.
You know, I mentioned the lawsuit I filed prior to 9/11. It was filed about a year before. Mm-hmm. Okay, 9/11 occurs. So I thought, well, okay, I'm going to make one last effort. So I filed a lawsuit in the federal courts in New York City. And again, it's very detailed, and this is, I want to report the corruption, the federal crimes that I and my group, my coalition of other insiders had discovered that was related to 9/11. So when they receive that, they have to file it. I paid the filing fee. All the papers were in order. But the Chief Judge McCasey blocked it, and he refused to allow it to be filed. So I sent letters to every justice of the U.S. Supreme Court advising them of the latest obstruction of justice by a federal judge over whom they had supervisory responsibility. So after I did that, then McCasey filed my lawsuit 13 months after it was received, and within a few hours, he's dismissing it. Well, first of all, he is required to at least receive the information, so that's an obstruction of justice. And, of course, due process on any civil action, before you dismiss it, you've got to give the person a notice of a hearing and allow him to present his argument why it should not be dismissed.
Right.
But anyhow, so here we have McCasey, and of course, you always got to protect the people that are on your side, so eventually they made him U.S. Attorney General. And
right, yeah, so we're talking about McCasey, the judge, who then became the U.S. Attorney General. Same guy.
Yeah, so they made him McCasey Attorney General sometime later.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So we are talking about the same man, okay.
Well, we've got a lot of people involved here, but just the public ever realized this. It would be massive corruption in the Department of Justice, massive corruption in the federal courts, and massive corruption, obstruction of justice by members of Congress. And, of course, I was keeping media informed of these things, too, and they did a very good job of covering up. Of course, so much of the media has been on the government secret payroll of the CIA and other government departments for years, so that would partly explain that.
Now, you've written 19 books, and in those books, have you actually taken this documentation and placed them in the books as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you have. So anyone who buys your books can look at the actual information or copies of the information that you filed with the Department of Justice and which you submitted to courts and everything else. So anyone who's listening, I want to can you please tell people how to go about getting your books?
Yeah, well, now, the easiest way, Amazon has them all. But now, if they go to the website, the main website is defraudingamerica.com, no spaces. Now, that website will have a list of most of the letters that I sent to members of Congress for the last 40 years. So you see there all of the areas of corruption. This is specific corruption now. And I identify myself as a former government agent, and also I identify myself as being the head of a coalition that includes a large number of other government agents, just like Ocho Pinto. You know, Ocho Pinto, he was so successful at arresting drug personnel, like I mentioned earlier, that Department of Justice then acted to go after a guy. And no one's ever been charged with a criminal civil rights violation for conducting a investigation of the premises. I mean, with all of the government personnel that go breaking down doors and all, who are never charged with anything, here Ocho Pinto and his group requested verbal okay before they inspected the premises. But then, of course, the drug dealers later said, oh, no, we didn't give him an okay.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, right. So here he ends up in prison. That pretty much shoots down the drug interdiction information. Now, incidentally, that's shortly before the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And, of course, the Jersey City, Ramzi Youssef in Jersey City, some of their money was coming from the drug activity. So by arresting Ocho Pinto, that kept those funds going.
So they arrested him on what specific charge? Did they arrest Ocho Pinto on not having warrants or any kind of,
they didn't
what was he charged with? was Ochipinti charged with when he went to jail?
Now, Ochipinti gave me a lot of information, and as he explained to me, it was simply, it was their practice to go to the bodegas and request verbal permission to investigate, conduct an investigation, and they got the verbal. So so they didn't force their way in. So,
he went to the drug dealer's bodegas, asked to search the residence by the permission of the people in the bodega, and he did so.
Yes, but then later on, they said, no, we didn't give him verbal. Well, that, you know, that's a relatively minor thing.
Right,
but
right.
Anyhow, so he's in prison, and then President George H.W. Bush and issues a pardon for the guy, but now he loses. I mean, he's no longer in government.
Mm-hmm.
But it
right.
sends a message to others, hey, and that message is well received by other government personnel because the list of people I have that have been retaliated against, these are good government people that they didn't play the game. So they paid the price, just like I paid the price.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And can you tell our audience what were some of the things that happened to you?
Well, first of all, you know, I left government. I refused to work under the corrupt conditions that were going on. So
mm-hmm.
I continued my exposure activities while I was out, but I was also investing in real estate. So I eventually had about $10 million in real estate in California. So like an idiot, instead of enjoying myself, I'm using the money to continue to publicize. I had a twin-engine plane. I would be flying all over the country, appearing on TV and radio shows. I mean, there's no money in doing something like this. And so what they did, and without going into the complex details, a CIA front law firm in San Francisco filed a sham charge legal action against me. Actually, that was in 82, and between 1982 and 2005, there was over 50 lawyers and law firms filing sham actions against me. But anyhow, what finally happened, first, when I'm trying to report these the criminal activities. Not only did federal judges refuse to receive it, but they issued orders that for the rest of my life, and that those orders are still valid, for the rest of my life bars me from filing any papers in any federal district or appellate court.
Huh.
Well, then I'm finding out more information after the first order, that order was written. So I try to report him again. This was to the federal courts in Sacramento. So U.S. Attorney David Levy, who was then promoted to a federal judge, charged me with criminal contempt of court for attempting to file filing papers in the federal courts that I was barred from doing. Well, first of all, an order like barring me for the remainder of my life from addressing federal filing papers in federal courts is about as unlawful and unconstitutional as you can get. And
mm-hmm.
of course, it was obviously obstruction of justice because they didn't want me to report these federal crimes. But anyhow, so we have the U.S. attorney, and there were several judges involved. And at the age of 67. No jury trial. They denied me a jury trial. I'm sent to federal prison for 6 months. And while I'm in federal prison, then without any notice to me, and there's more involved in this, but I'm giving you the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
They issue an order seizing and liquidating my assets. Now, those are the assets that they knew were funding my exposure activities. Well, that order was, I think, about 1987, and it took them from 1987 to about 1995 to liquidate all my assets. I had a lot of assets. I had motels, truck stops, apartment. I had over 100 apartments, a lot of land. And so I guess they figured, well, that would be the end of me. Well, matter of fact, then when I did get a chance to file an objection to it, I'm charged with criminal contempt of court again for filing objections to the seizure and liquidation of my assets because the judge had earlier rendered an order barring me from filing any objections. I mean, this is true.
Talk about totally illegal. They denied your right for trial. They denied your right to file documents reporting crimes. They threw you in jail. They stole your property and your assets. And this is law? It's disgusting, Rodney. It's terrible.
Well, think of the big picture, though. All of this was to keep me from reporting the corruption in the same areas that were made 9/11 possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it takes, someone has to spend a little time to realize this. And people don't seem to want to read these type of books, especially the last few years since the internet and all of the video games has come in.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't reading much anymore. So, you know, when I get on a radio show like this, I feel it's a waste of time because no one listens. But what I try to do, I get a little satisfaction out of at least showing how the public are not only victims but enablers of their own fate by not spending a little time to look at the facts, what's being done to them. They're being taken for saps by just about every Tom, Dick, and Harry, starting with members of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about giving it? I mean, have you ever introduced any of your information to like movie producers, or has anybody wanted to tell these stories? I mean, you know, I would think that if they made movies about some of these stories, they would be pretty interesting, wouldn't you think?
Well, the first contact I had was right after the first book came out in 1978, Jackie Cooper. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Jackie Cooper.
But I believe he's from The Little Rascals, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he was a movie. Then he became a movie producer.
Yeah,
so,
and didn't he also play in The Addams Family? Was that Uncle Fester? Oh, no, that's Jackie Coogan. Okay, different guy, sorry.
Anyhow, I went down to Los Angeles and met with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do a 3-part television series on just my first book, which was the first edition of Unfriendly Skies.
Mm-hmm.
And but what he eventually found out is nobody would fund something like that. But anyhow, about 10 years ago, I had, and these are totally unsolicited, I had two different outfits in Los Angeles contact me about wanting to do a television series on the book Defrauding America.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 10 years ago, but I didn't follow up on it, and so I guess whatever happened. But the thing is, nobody will, just like some of the television investigative reporters of the past, everyone that tried to come out with something relatively serious, they're off the air. And that's in one of my books, I list some of those. And just like Operation Tailwind, the producer that came out with that, he got fired. And then remember, what's his name, who came out with exposing President Bush's Texas National Guard record.
Mm-hmm.
He got fired, and but that's the way it is, and so there's no one will touch anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the San Jose Mercury had a series of articles on the CIA drug smuggling. Eventually, other media went after them, and they finally, then the publisher apologized, saying, "Well, the support was lacking for what they were writing about." And then investigative reporter that was writing the articles, he was fired, and eventually he committed suicide. It's not a very pretty picture for anybody who tries to protect national interests from the Trojan horse corruption that we have.
Right. Okay, we have to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back. Okay, Rodney?
Okay.
All right. Stay tuned for Freedom Fighters for America Radio and Mr. Rodney Stitch. We'll return momentarily.